You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Creativity is always, as Joyce Carol Oates says, an experiment. And that's a quote from David Eagleman and Anthony Brandt's new book, fabulous book, The Runaway Species. And since our species is so creative, where does one find the motherlode of human invention? What kind of software does our brain use to find that motherlode? Using examples from engineering science, product design, music, and the visual arts, neuroscientist David Eagleman and composer and professor Anthony Brandt trace the roots of creative thinking. What are the basic strategies? What patterns do they follow? In the author's exuberant collaboration, they find their own strategies for making the complex readable and opening a fascinating world that exists between predictability and surprise. Visiting us from Houston, Anthony Brandt is a composer and professor at Rice University's Shepherd School of Music. He's also a graduate of CalArts. He's also the artistic director of the contemporary music ensemble Musica. He's written two chamber operas and works for orchestra, chamber ensembles, dance, theater, film, television, and sound and art installations. David Eagleman, who you may have heard at Aloud before, is a neuroscientist and the New York Times bestselling author of Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, and the novel Sum, among others. He's the writer and host of the Emmy-nominated PBS television series The Brain. He's an adjunct professor at Stanford and the director of the Center for Science and Law. It's a delight to welcome these two creative minds here to Aloud. Let's give them both a warm welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a terrific pleasure to be back here at the Aloud series. So let's get this rolling.
So when you fly over a forest, it looks the same as 10,000 years ago, even 100,000 years ago.
But the interesting part is that when you fly over any modern city, it looks completely different. It looks like a motherboard has risen out of the earth, and this is all due to one single species. And so the question is, what makes humans so special?
Why don't squirrels design elevators?
Why don't alligators invent speedboats?
Why don't koala bears spend their free time writing novels?
It's a good question. And the answer has to do a little bit with opposable thumbs and larynx, but it has a lot more to do with the structure of the human brain. So when we zoom in on the brains of different species, it's not just the size that matters. A key change with the expansion of the human cortex, which is the outer bit, the wrinkly part, is that there got to be this really large distance between input and output. So what that means is when we get some input, we don't have to act reflexively, but instead there's all this room, there's all this brain area where we take in ideas and we can chew on things and manipulate ideas and then maybe act or not. And this allows us to generate rich possibilities. And there's a second thing too, which is that it's part of the expansion of the cortex. We got this much larger prefrontal cortex, the part right behind your forehead. And this is the part of the brain that allows us to simulate possible futures, to simulate what ifs. And so human creativity is mostly what it is, thanks to these subtle changes that happen with the expansion of the cortex. And this is what allows us to always lean into the future, generating possibilities and evaluating them.
And one of the consequences of this is that we don't tolerate too much repetition. So maybe you've seen the movie Groundhog Day, in which a weatherman played by Bill Murray is forced to relive Groundhog Day over and over again. But he refuses to live the same day the same way twice. He learns French, becomes a piano virtuoso, plays matchmaker. Why isn't Bill just satisfied to be a creature of habit?
Well, answer has to do with the brain is always seeking novelty. Doing the same thing over and over is uninteresting to it. So when we look at brain activity, we see big responses when the brain sees something new. But if you show it the same thing over and over, it burns less and less energy on it. And so this is a phenomenon called repetition suppression, which is if the same thing is repeated, the brain doesn't care about it as much more. And so it's this thirst for novelty that's the fountainhead of our creativity. But
we don't want too much novelty. We're happy to be a Burning Man for a few days, but we don't want to be there the whole year. There's a trade-off between exploring the unknown and exploiting what we already know. And there's this constant tug of war in the brain between novelty and familiarity. Too much predictability and we tune out. Too many surprises and we become disoriented. Creativity lives in that tension. And that's why our world is so densely populated with skeuomorphs, the computer icons for objects in the real world. So for instance, the save icon is a floppy disk, which hasn't been part of computer hardware in over a decade. The phone icon is an old phone handset, which none of our children have ever seen. We send emails with an envelope letter. We throw out files we don't want, which are just zeros and one, into a trash can, and we buy online in a shopping cart. All of this is a way of keeping an umbilical cord to the past.
So as a result of these two opposing drives between novelty and familiarity, we surround ourselves with things that have never existed, but they're practical next steps for us. And what that means is that all new ideas evolve from the old.
So innovations that define this generation, like the iPhone, seem to be bolts out of the blue, but they're not. This is the IBM Simon from 1993, it was a touchscreen cell phone introduced two decades before Steve Jobs' big reveal. Although it may not always be obvious or visible, there was a smooth progression that connected us from there to here. Creativity always is based on prior experience. Every new idea has a history. As Henry Ford said about the Model T, "I invented nothing new. I simply assembled into a car the discoveries of other men behind whom were centuries of work."
And human innovation comes from a continual process of branching and selection. So we try out a lot of ideas, and some of them survive, and those that do become the basis of selection for the next generation of ideas and experimentation. So if ideas all have a history, is it possible to understand how they evolve? Can we describe how ideas interact to lead to the next generation of ideas?
So we propose a framework that divides the landscape of cognitive operation into three basic strategies: bending, breaking, and blending. These are the primary means by which all ideas evolve. In bending, it's like a theme in variations. You take a source and you manipulate it, you transform it, you twist it out of shape in some way.
In breaking, you take something whole and you break it up into pieces.
And in blending, you merge two or more sources. So if you take a man and blend it with a bull, in ancient Greece, you get a minotaur.
So bending, breaking, and blending are the main brain operations that underlie creative thinking. And by applying this cognitive software to everything around us, we're constantly generating an ongoing tidal wave of novel worlds.
Now, creativity can be difficult to see. A lot of the time, it's hidden under the hood and inaccessible. So take YouTube. A few years ago, they introduced high-definition video, and everybody wanted it. It was very exciting, but there was a problem. HD files are huge, and they were jamming up people's computer. And the problem for YouTube was that YouTube has no control over the bandwidth flowing to your computer. That's under the purview of your internet provider. So how are they going to solve this intractable problem? Well, YouTube files are stored in three resolutions: high definition, standard, and low. And YouTube engineers took the files of those different resolutions, broke them up into very short clips, and then devised software that analyzed the moment-to-moment fluctuations in bandwidth flowing to your computer. So when there's enough bandwidth for the high-res clips to flow, that's what gets sent to your computer. On the other hand, when the bandwidth narrows, then you get sent the low-res clips. And as long as there are enough high-res clips mixed into your stream, you don't notice that there's the low-res ones also. All you notice is that your streaming didn't pause. So that's a very creative solution, but here's the rub. It's designed to be undetectable.
And many examples of creativity are covert like that. So we typically don't know what's behind the facade of a building, even though it's an ingenious network of pipes and wires and ducts and so on. Everything that keeps the whole system running, it's all invisible to us. But when you look at the Pompidou Center in Paris, the air ducts and pipes and wiring on the outside of the building, and that's what the arts give us, overt creativity. The arts showcase the creativity that otherwise lies hidden in our daily lives. They expose the innards of the creative process.
So whether creativity is overt or covert, the cognitive tools are the same. Now let's take a closer look at how bending, breaking, and blending give birth to new ideas. We'll start with bending. Humans will bend just about anything we can get our hands on. So for instance, these are bends of the human form, all from different cultures, and these are bends of horses.
And you can bend anything, like our biology. So just as an example, hearts fail, and scientists began to wonder if they could make an artificial heart. And so in 1982, this is what the artificial heart looked like. It was a mechanical pump, but the problem was it was big and heavy, and it was energy hungry, and it got worn down. And so in 2004, some doctors in the Texas Medical Center came up with a novel solution. Instead of a pump, why not use a continuous flow? So blood gets oxygenated as it passes through, and it goes right back out. And when you have one of these installed, you no longer have a pulse. So Dick Cheney has one of these. He doesn't have any pulse. And the key is this. There's a heart inside your chest, but it doesn't use exactly the same principles as what nature gave you. It's a bend of what is found in nature.
So sources can be bent in many ways. So, for instance, you can bend an object's size. For the Rio Olympics, the artist JR built an image of the high jumper Muhammad Idris several stories high. And just as bending can enlarge, it can also shrink. These are miniature figurines by the sculptor Alberto Giacometti.
And these examples of overt creativity expose the same creative approach that allowed scientists to solve a big problem with automobiles. In the early 1920s, there was a lot of glare from headlights, and it was dangerous to drive at night as a result of that. So a scientist named Edwin Land knew that he could eliminate the glare with large polarizing crystals, but they were too big to use in a windshield. So his aha moment was the same thinking that was behind Giacometti's figurines. He realized the solution was to get these crystals down to a very small size. So he made glass sheets with thousands of these tiny crystals embedded inside of them. And the driver got a better view of the road, but the creativity that produced it remained invisible. Not me.
That's all right. Size is just one of the features that can be bent. Architect Frank Gehry looked at the typically flat facades of buildings and wondered if he could bend the shape. And here's a Gehry building in Lower Manhattan.
A similar bend is refashioning the future of cars. So one of the impediments from converting engines from gasoline to hydrogen is the bulkiness of the tank. So hydrogen tanks are barrel-shaped and they take up a lot of cargo space. So a company in San Francisco developed a tank that folds upon itself in layers and it can snake into the unused parts of the car body, finding ways to make the volume work by twisting it.
So the human brain will even bend time. This clip from the movie 300 bends the speed. And time can even run backward.
And this sort of overt creativity is the same as the covert creativity that's found in the sciences. So the ability to run films backward got the physicist Ernst Stueckelberg to run a new kind of thought experiment. And he realized he could describe the behavior of elementary particles if he simply assumed that some of them were running backward in time. So it turns out that the particles that we call electrons are equivalent to protons racing the other way in time. And that bending won him the Nobel Prize.
So several scientists are currently pursuing the goal of cloning a Neanderthal by reversing the arrow of time. The idea is to start with a human genome, run evolution backwards, undo all of the genetic changes that separate us from these distant ancestors. So by bending time, these scientists hope to bring the Neanderthal back to life.
And when you start looking at creativity all around you, you'll notice lots of bending. So some are mild, as in caricature, and sometimes the bending is more extreme. This is a self-portrait of Francis Bacon. Just by changing the degree of bending, new possibilities open up.
We might sometimes fall prey to the end of time illusion, in which we believe that everything that can be done has already been done. But the history of bending tells a different story. There's always more to squeeze out. Take knives. They're practical, well-established tools. And this collection of knives is all from 19th century Polynesia. Cultures around the world have never stopped bending the knife.
And look at umbrellas. These have existed since ancient times. But with the modern folding umbrella, it finally seems like we've reached the end of the line. But the United States Patent Office continues to receive so many patent applications for umbrellas that they have four full-time examiners just on the topic of umbrellas. So, for instance, the asymmetric shape at the top gives better wind resistance. This one's worn like a backpack, making it hands-free. That one has the ribs on the outside, and so on. Because of our perpetual manipulations, human culture never stops exploring variations on themes.
Now let's turn to the second tool of innovation, breaking. New things are often built by taking something that already exists and taking it apart. We find examples of breaking all throughout the arts. Let's listen now to a clip from the French national anthem. Okay, and now let's hear how Tchaikovsky incorporates that fragment into his 1812 overture. So Tchaikovsky couldn't have written that passage without the ability to break the national anthem into smaller pieces and then build that into his orchestral piece. Cubism shattered the visual plane into a mosaic of multiple perspectives. And this is Barnett Newman's broken obelisk, in which he snaps an obelisk in half.
And the breaking that's so easy to observe in the arts, it's the same creative act that happens in the scientific lab. It's just harder to see. So this is Fred Sanger, and he was trying to figure out a way to read the sequence of long molecules of DNA, and he devised a way to break up those molecules into much shorter bits, which allowed him to more easily analyze and then collate these. And he won two Nobel Prizes for this breaking techniques, which are responsible for most of what we know about genomes.
There are a lot of ways to break something. David Hockney created this photo collage using relatively large pieces. Meanwhile, in this pointillistic painting by Seurat, the pieces are much smaller and there are a lot more of them.
And in digital pixelation, the dots are so small that you're not even supposed to see them. And this kind of covert pixelation is the innovation that underlies our whole digital universe.
So breaking also gives you the opportunity to leave pieces out. Bruno Catalano leaves out whole chunks of the human body in his sculpture, The Travelers. The artist Corey Archangel created a video installation by hacking into the computer game Super Mario Brothers and removing everything but the clouds. He then projects the clouds onto large screens for his installation, Super Mario Clouds.
And you can see the same principles at work in my field. So when you look at a brain, it's hard to see where the pathways originate and where they go. But there's a new method called Clarity, which washes away the fatty molecules and leaves the rest of the structure intact. So just as Archangel removed part of the video game for his Mario Brothers installation, the same creative approach in laboratory allows us to remove most of the brain and see the remainder in a new way.
Ungluing the pieces allows the structure to change shape. So David Fisher's dynamic architecture breaks apart the typically solid frame of a building and allows the floors to move independently.
And engineers designing a prosthetic hand realized that they didn't have to be limited by biology. So our wrists are constrained by tendons, but the engineers realized they could break that constraint. Why not design a wrist that can just keep on turning? So whether you're an artist or a scientist, breaking opens up a whole new world of creative options to take things apart and put the pieces together in new ways.
Now we'll move on to the last of the creative tools, blending, which merges sources. So all over the world, cultures have blended humans and animals to create mythological creatures. In ancient Egypt, if you blend a man with a lion, you get a sphinx. In Nigeria, if you blend a woman with a fish, you get a mamiwata. And in Italy, if you blend a lion and a goat, you get this chimera.
And what happens in myth also happens in science. So spider silk is much stronger than steel, and a lot of people have been interested in harvesting lots of spider silk. But it turns out if you try to get a bunch of spiders together to harvest it, they'll fight and they'll eat each other. And so a geneticist came up with a really interesting idea akin to the mythological creatures. And what he did is he spliced the DNA for making spider silk into a goat. And the result is Freckles the spider goat, who secretes spider silk in her milk. She's a real-life chimera.
So blending is pervasive in the arts. For instance, in hip-hop music, fragments from previous music are repurposed or blended together to create a new song. Here's a drum solo called the Amen Break from a 1969 song by the Winstons. That solo has been blended into a track by Mantronix and Salt and Peppa and almost 2,000 other songs, all of which have blended the DNA of the old into the new.
And the brain can make really exotic combinations from things it's seen before. So, for example, in this video installation, a woman's breathing torso is blended with a lifeless pile of gravel. And a similar blend forms the solution to the problem of the world's crumbling buildings and roads. So half of the world's structures are made out of concrete, but concrete gets worn down by weather and it's hard to repair. So scientists blended concrete with a bacterium that secretes calcite, which is one of concrete's main ingredients. And as long as the concrete is intact, the bacteria lie dormant. But if the concrete cracks, then the bacteria wake up and they spawn and they spread and they excrete calcite, which seals up the damage. So as a result of this blend of the living and the non-living, the concrete heals itself.
So human imagination places no limits on what can be blended with what. So for instance, you can blend the past with the present.
And you can blend the present and the future.
Sometimes the elements of a blend touch, but they don't merge. So for instance, I.M. Pei blended an Egyptian pyramid into the courtyard of the Louvre Palace, and Frida Kahlo painted her head on the body of a deer. Other times, sources are more merged. So for instance, in the Blur building, the walls are made of water, and in Craig Walsh's installation, human portraits are projected onto trees. And here, the sources are even more thoroughly mixed. It's hard to tell that Jasper John's painting consists of the numbers 0 through 9 superimposed on each other.
And we're surrounded by these sorts of blends, typically in ways that we can't see. So 5,000 years ago, humans realized that you could blend copper and tin to make the first alloy. And you can't really tell that this flexible material is a blend of two others. But this simple move launched our species into all the successes of the Bronze Age. Now, when you import an image into a graphics program and do something like rotate image, the software actually doesn't care if it's a photo of nests or zebras or kazoos. All it's doing is running an algorithm that operates on the zeros and ones. And in the same way, our neural networks process mental input using standard subroutines, whether we're thinking about a patent or a new musical riff or a new recipe or what to say next, we transform the raw materials of our experience by bending, breaking, and blending them.
And we're all running this software under the hood. Creativity doesn't emerge out of thin air. We depend on culture to give us a storehouse of raw materials, which we then transform.
And we don't just replace the things that don't work. We update the things that we love. And that's why fashions are constantly changing and haircuts evolve through the decades and car makers come out with new models every year. It's not that what's out now isn't good. It's that next year we want something even better.
So Edouard Manet broke good to create his 1863 painting Le Déjeuner sur l'Herbe. Using this 15th century engraving as a starting point, Manet transformed the three mythological figures in the lower right-hand corner into two bourgeois gentlemen and a prostitute lounging in a Parisian park. The resulting painting helped to launch modern art.
And later, Picasso innovated on what Manet had done. He showed his love for Manet by remodeling it.
And several generations after that, Robert Colescott remodeled Picasso's iconic Les Demoiselles d'Avignon into his Les Demoiselles d'Alabama. Creativity is propelled when we treat the past as treasured, but not untouchable.
So what we'd like you to do for just a moment is imagine yourself on a beach at sunset. So take a moment to picture yourself there. Okay, so how many of you pictured some coconut husks on the beach, by a show of hands? How many of you pictured some swimmers in the water? How about some the white foam tips of the wave? How about a crescent moon in the sky? Okay, so pretty impoverished, right? And the question is, the question is why? Why is it so impoverished? Well, here's why. It turns out every concept in the brain is connected to other concepts that are related to it in this rich network of associations. So when I asked about the beach, you could have pulled up any of that stuff that could be related to it, but you didn't. And the interesting part is why. So instead, when we thought about a beach, we thought about sand and water. And this is the concept of the path of least resistance. So your brain has evolved to be ruthlessly efficient in getting what it needs to get to. So if you're hungry in historical times, you go and you find food. You don't dance or paint or something like that. But the good news is there is a way to dig down in there again and find all that data that's in there, all that rich connectivity that exists in there. There's a way to get back at that.
Proliferate options.
Yes.
Don't imagine there's a single answer. Anytime you generate a solution, challenge yourself to come up with another and another and another. Generating a spectrum of options is a cornerstone of the creative process. So here's Velasquez's painting Las Meninas, along with four of 57 variations that Picasso painted of Velasquez's painting.
And just as in the arts, generating options is crucial in the sciences. So in the post-Reconstruction South, decades of cotton farming had ruined the soil. And so George Washington Carver realized that an ideal rotation crop would be the peanut. But he understood that Southern farmers wouldn't plant this unless there was a market for them. So he invented over 100 uses for the peanut, including peanut oil and milk and face cream and ice cream and punch and glue. And he was given 10 minutes to testify before the House Ways and Means Committee about the value of peanut farming. But he so impressed the committee with his proliferation of options that he ended up testifying for a full hour.
So in what we've just seen, Picasso and Carver put their proliferation on display. Often, though, the generation of options occurs behind the scenes. So industrial designer Max Kulik sketched dozens of versions of a single-person vehicle with the driver seated or standing, one, two, or three wheels, a rigid or a fold-up frame, on his way to designing the City Smoother, his concept vehicle.
And Thomas Edison set idea quotas for his employees. So whenever they were facing a new challenge, he wouldn't say, okay, come back with a solution tomorrow. He'd say, come back with seven solutions tomorrow. And this inspired productivity at a different level because it forced people to dig deeper. So industrious minds are constantly pushing themselves off the path of least resistance by generating an ongoing stream of alternatives. So as we land on creative solutions, we constantly need to ask ourselves, what else can I come up with?
And there's another twist to proliferation. As we've seen, all creativity is tethered to its history. The question is how far to move away from it. On the one hand, if you stay too close to the familiar, you may be left behind. So take the BlackBerry smartphone, the first mobile phone to incorporate a QWERTY keyboard. Here's the BlackBerry's market share. What happened? Well, the BlackBerry started off as a winning idea, but the company didn't anticipate how fast touchscreen technology would catch on. The company held on to the right answer for too long.
Sometimes holding on to earlier successes is not enough. A big leap is what seizes the public imagination. But there's also a risk of going too far, which is that nobody might follow you there. So just as an example, between the end of the Civil War and the start of World War II, there were several hundred attempts to create a universal language. And dignitaries like Eleanor Roosevelt were really behind this because they understood that a shared language would help with world peace. And of course, you know, the most famous example of that was Esperanto, which came closer than anything else to achieving that vision. Just after the Second World War, 500,000 people petitioned the United Nations to adopt Esperanto as the official world language. Here's a clip from a William Shatner movie that was filmed entirely in Esperanto. But ultimately, despite all the great acting, Esperanto failed to catch on. And so, although we all know that our world would be enriched by having a universal language, asking populations to learn an entirely new language was just too big a move.
It can be challenging to find the sweet spot between familiarity and novelty. Sticking closely to what works can quickly wear out its welcome, but leaving the comfortable too far behind can fail to find followers. The solution is to go different distances from community standards. So, for instance, designer Sarah Burton created the traditional wedding dress worn by Kate Middleton at her royal wedding. But she's also created other wedding dresses less likely to be worn at imperial nuptials.
And the same person who patented this blouse and refrigerator also came up with the theory of relativity.
In the early 1930s, industrial designer Norman Bel Geddes devised a host of practical commercial products, all very successful, including radios, cocktail shakers, furniture, kitchen appliances. But Bel Geddes didn't stop there. He also came up with futuristic-looking buses, a flying car, an aerial restaurant in which diners were perched on a rotating mechanism over 20 stories high, and a wall-less house in which the walls rise up into the ceiling just like garage doors.
And innovative companies follow a similar strategy of covering the spectrum. So Mercedes-Benz is constantly upgrading its sedans, but its engineers have also conceived of the Biome concept car, which is a biodegradable car that would be grown entirely from seeds. And the car's zero emissions fuel wouldn't be stored in a tank, but it would flow through the car's frames and wheels, and its electronics would be powered by a solar sunroof. So for now, the Biome car exists only on the computer, and Mercedes has no immediate plans to develop it. But the goal of a concept car isn't to actually be the next car. Instead, it's to focus on a far-reaching possibility. It allows a company to examine what's on the distant horizon, whether or not society ever goes in that direction.
Similarly, Microsoft is constantly improving its computer servers, but it doesn't stop there. Because the circuitry of the servers generates a massive amount of heat, Microsoft is also experimenting with submersible tanks that would house the computer servers in the depths of the ocean. The first prototype made it back safely to shore, covered with barnacles.
And in a similar vein, the company Fisher-Price is continually upgrading its cradles and strollers and toys, but it also has an eye on what's coming further down the line. So its Future of Parenting line examines how technological advances might impact the child-rearing of tomorrow.
The person who only tinkers with prior art is probably going to be weak on breakthroughs, while the person who dives full-time into moonshots may never develop the competency to build anything that actually works. So instead of remaining at a fixed distance, an optimal strategy is to generate a range of ideas, some of which stay closer to home, while others fly farther.
And finally, we have to embrace risk when doing this sort of thing. You can't attempt something new and ever rest assured about the results. For every good idea that made it, a lot of others didn't survive. It takes a high risk tolerance to be creative. For instance, to invent the bagless vacuum cleaner, it took James Dyson 15 years and over 5,000 prototypes.
So across human history, new ideas take root in environments where failure is tolerated. It's important to be fearless in the face of error.
So let's recap.
Creativity is part of the software of every human brain.
Innovation doesn't come out of thin air. Ideas evolve. All new ideas have a history.
The creative process transcends disciplines. We bend, break, and blend our storehouse of experiences remodeling what we know.
Creativity is overt in the arts, which is why we need to include them in the way we educate our children.
We propel our creativity when we break good, go different distances from community standards, proliferate options, and tolerate risk.
We're a species with a runaway imagination. Our innate cognitive software has produced a society with increasingly faster innovation, one that feeds upon its latest ideas. So we have currently 8 billion brains running around the planet, and they're all running this cognitive software of creativity. And also, there are more raw materials than ever to bend, break, and blend. And as far as we can tell, no other species puts as much effort into exploring imaginary territories as we do.
All of us are chiseling in the cliffside of history to build our tomorrows. It's something we're all capable of, something we all do in our own way. And by understanding our ability to innovate, our most profound, mysterious, and deeply human capacity, we can all go out to remake our world.
Thank you. And now we'll take any questions on anything you've ever wanted to know about creativity. I think people are running around with mics.
Why do so many people not feel creative?
I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think too often someone told them when they were young, you're not creative. And I think that's one of the reasons that we wrote the book, is sort of to just put that to rest, that that would ever really be possible. Another thing is, I think sometimes we tend to look up at the great giants, and compared to them, we all feel small. But one of the things we constantly strive to show in the book is that those great creatives, often when their ideas are first introduced in the world, they're very vulnerable. I mean, Picasso rolled up the canvas for Les Demoiselles d'Avignon and hid it in his closet for 9 years. And Alfred Wegener, who came up with the theory of continental drift, essentially died with maybe 2 people believing that he had discovered anything useful. And so it's important, especially with children, to take the attitude that everyone is filled with possibilities and always to recognize that in ourselves.
Many of the examples that you gave of innovation were from science, engineering, art, but it seems like there were no examples from social institutions, and it seems like humans do innovate in social institutions, but much more slowly. So, for example, it took a very long time for democracy to overcome monarchies. So can you talk a little bit about why we are so slow in innovating social institutions and how we can do better?
I think part of the issue there is just that it has to be a little bit slow, which is to say, when you build a constitution, you have to say it is changeable, but not, you know, not tomorrow and the next day. It just exists on its own timescale. But you're exactly right in pointing out that everything that humans create, whether it's corporations or legal systems or systems of government for a country, communism or democracy or whatever, all of that stuff is, at least as far as we can tell, something that other animal species don't do at all. And it all comes from the same very basic thing about saying, okay, well, I'm observing how this troop runs. What if I did that? What if I smash this? What if I do that? You put all these ideas together, and eventually, over the course of, you know, some tens of thousands of years in our case, all that stuff has come together to be this proliferation of 212 countries, each of which have different government systems. In our country, we've got 50 states, each of which is a little petri dish for its own system of government. It's this thing that is so mind-blowing when you compare us to other species which don't do that at all.
So with the advent of things like the Human Genome Project and CRISPR-Cas9, have we entered a period of hyper-evolution where we no longer rely on natural selection to sort of get us to the next level of humanhood, I guess?
Yes. There's a sense in which we've been there for a while, though. I mean, as soon as we started curing any kind of infectious disease or whatever, then suddenly the natural selection in its most natural form wasn't happening anymore. We were keeping kids alive and so on. So we've been in that for a long time. But we're very much in that situation right now where we are able to not only fix diseases, but actually add on to what humans can do, whether that's the motor system giving people new kinds of skills, or the sensorium where you can take in different kinds of information that would have been impossible before. And, you know, just the fact that we all walk around with the entirety of humankind's knowledge in our pockets is so extraordinary. And it changes our society in a big way. Maybe we'll talk more about that. But you know, this means that, you know, most of us here grew up at a time when, you know, if we were lucky, our parents would drive us down to the library and we'd take out the Encyclopedia Britannica and we'd flip through it and find the article we wanted. But now you can get everything right there. And it's pretty extraordinary. I think it's going to, I mean, for sure, from a neuroscience point of view, this changes the next generation a lot. We happen to be very cyber-optimistic about this, which is to say it's probably going to make the next generation a lot smarter than we are, simply because they've got more raw materials to bend, break, and blend. They can just access anything. And we all know what it's like at, you know, dinner parties nowadays are just really different than they were 20 years ago. Because as soon as an argument comes up, it's just a matter of who can whip out their phone the fastest and solve it. So it's really a terrific situation that we're in.
Your book and so beautifully demonstrates collaboration is a big part of the creative process. Could you both talk a little bit about your process in writing this book? How did you do it? Like, how do you work together?
Well, there's a well-worn dining room table that used to be in Mercer Street in Houston, where we would meet at David's house every weekend to work on the book. And we had sort of one golden rule, which was that we could each bring any kind of raw material to the table that we wanted. And if the other person went, oh, then it just went. And we didn't argue. We didn't fight about it. And it made the process of working together so super fun, because if we did agree, then there was a lot of confidence that that was a great thing to put in the book. And if it didn't resonate with both of us, then we just felt that it wasn't really going to work. And so a lot of it was just bringing loads of examples and curating it. And we started basically with the skeleton of our argument from the beginning and stuck fairly close to that all the way through. So having that architecture really helped us a lot.
Yeah, and I'll just add, Tony and I have been friends for a long time. About 4 years ago, we met for a coffee. I don't remember why. We were just chatting, catching up on stuff. And it turns out we'd both been thinking a lot and starting to give talks on creativity. And we started to talk about our points of view and realized it was, you know, the same thing that converged very beautifully. And so at that coffee, we decided we're going to write a book on this. And then here it is 4 years later. Yeah.
Is there such a thing as manipulating the brain so you can be more creative?
I didn't hear the key word. Is there a thing as what, thing the brain?
Manipulating the brain.
Yes. It turns out that, you know, following these very basic structures about getting in the habit, for example, of proliferating options is a really important one. So by setting up structures of how you're going to do things, I run a startup company on the side, and, you know, and I get all my employees to do this. If they're going to come up with a solution to something, you know, I just copied Edison on this, but the idea is to make them come up with lots of solutions, not just lots of solutions, but solutions at different distances, things like that. Now, there are other sorts of manipulations like psychedelic drugs and so on, but here's the reason that that's not that useful for creativity, which is there's actually two halves to creativity. One is the generation of new ideas, and the other is filtering. And it turns out that when people are on drugs, they come up with all kinds of super creative, interesting things, but what they're not very good at doing is saying, nope, that won't work, strike that one, which is what you do when you're sober. And so that's the so there are all kinds of ways to be more creative. But anyway, that's the really important piece of it. And I'll just mention, because the question will probably come up at some point, which is, can AI, artificial intelligence, be creative? And the answer is, right now, there are extraordinary examples of AI generating all kinds of super cool artistic things. There's Google Deep Dream. There's Google Magenta. There's all kinds of different projects like that. But what it can't do is know which of these 10,000 things I just came up with have some sort of resonance with human beings. And so that's the half that it can't do at all, because it doesn't know what it is to be a human being. So,
So Anthony, you had mentioned something about especially in children. So I was wondering if you think that, or both of you think that creativity is born or if it is learned?
Well, there's no question that every child all over the world plays as when they're young. And to see that in every child, you just know that creativity is a universal part of the human brain. The problem is that we often think about it as something that children grow out of. But our argument would be human beings never grow out of that. And in fact, we need a language, for instance, that enables us to improvise when we talk to each other so we can continue to surprise each other at dinner parties and things like that. In that sense, everyone is born with that equipment. It isn't to say that everyone is necessarily equal in the same sense that not everybody runs as fast as each other, but the basic software is in every brain, and we also are really firmly convinced that cultivating that in every child is something that is teachable, that is something that is very rewarding, and that is something that every child, especially right now in the 21st century, desperately needs in order to navigate the world that's coming on the horizon. And so it's a combination of both things. They're both incredibly important. And, you know, one of our motivations for writing the book was to argue for more arts in the schools, for instance. There was this amazing study that just came out that showed that taking comparable levels of achievement in math, inventors are much more likely to come from privileged neighborhoods than underprivileged neighborhoods, with no other distinction between the categories of people. And it's just a reminder of how important it is to be widely dispersed in our nurturing of creativity.
I'll leave off off one thing there, which is about this thing of preparing children for the future. If you think about the jobs that exist right now, that didn't exist when we were growing up, whether that's a blogger or a multimedia designer or whatever, just all kinds of jobs that we didn't even know were a thing when we were growing up. Just imagine 30 years from now. So it's not that the point of our education systems is to teach kids how to be an electrical engineer or whatever. It's that we need to teach them cognitive flexibility. We need to teach them how to use their brains in a way to put new ideas together and do things in an interesting way, because we have no idea what jobs will exist for them in that future.
A big point that you made came at the end when you talked about what it takes for innovation to arise. You said it's a tolerance of risk or a lack of fear of failure. I'm paraphrasing, but I've heard this stated elsewhere. And what interests me is that, you know, when I hear you talk about, well, throwing out seven solutions instead of just one solution, that appears to me an approach on an individual level or a small group level. But if you back higher up to the societal level, there's been regions around the world that have tried to mimic and duplicate Silicon Valley success and have failed. And so I'm curious whether your work has touched upon what gives rise to societies that are innovative, that tolerate risk, that encourage risk, and is there a way to cultivate that from a societal level?
Yeah, terrific. I mean, thank you so much for that question, because one of the things that we didn't really touch on in the talk is the degree to which creativity is such a social endeavor. And so there's this myth about the isolated artist, but it turns out any story that you examine, whether that's Van Gogh or whoever, it's completely apocryphal. They were totally embedded in their society. And one of the things that fascinated me during the writing of this book was to understand, you know, if you just take some moment in time, let's say some, you know, middle of the 17th century, and you compare Japanese art to British art to Cambodian art to whatever, it's not that any of these artists couldn't have done something like the others. It's that we are products of our society, and it really matters what kind of things we're absorbing. All this is to say, there are ways that societies come into place in just the right sort of way, like Paris in the 1920s and New York at various points and so on, Silicon Valley currently, where you have a density of people all there and willing to do stuff, and you get this collection of people that are all bouncing the stuff around. It's not that people in, you know, Peoria, Illinois aren't coming up with clever ideas for the next website or mobile app. It's just that there's not the scene around them. This is what Brian Eno calls the scenius, which is the genius of a scene. But the idea is it's totally a social endeavor.
I think a lot of the things that we often call failures end up absorbed into the things we call successes. And so it's almost like we're all tilling the soil and then a big breakthrough will happen. And then coming back to also one of your points, which was really excellent. But you know, we have in the book the Architectural Research Office was commissioned to do this new theater in New York for the Flea Theater, and they worked up over 70 facades. And in the end, they only picked one. And so, you know, you want to say, well, what were the other ones all failures? And of course they weren't. They were part of the process at arriving at the optimal solution. And that's why the notion of failure isn't even the right word, because it sounds like it's always a loss or something negative. But that's a healthy sign that they were able to proliferate so much in order to come up with something that they had the maximum confidence in.
Do you have an explanation or a theory of why other species with large brains, like whales and gorillas, let's say, have not developed a level of creativity that humans have over all these millennia?
Yeah, great question. It turns out that there are several species with brains that are bigger than ours, like elephants, for example, and whales. Horses have the same size brain as we do. But it turns out that the ratio of their brain to their body size is... that number is fixed across the animal kingdom, which is to say, the bigger the body you have, the bigger the brain. Why? Because the reason a whale or an elephant has a big brain is because they need to take care of gathering signals from all of that body and controlling that big, giant body. Humans are the only ones that are off of that line of brain size to body size. We've got a much bigger brain to our tiny little bodies. And that's what seems to make all the difference. Just some series of genetic mutations that cause us to blow this up. With all the other requisite innovations, like, you know, a woman's hips being large enough that she could pass the baby through the birth canal and so on. Yeah. Who knows how we got here? Yeah.
Hi. I was wondering if you know of Csikszentmihalyi's work on finding flow, because a lot of your creativity stuff sounded like that to me.
Ah. You had.
Of course, the idea of flow is that there's these certain optimal times when you're just in the zone. And when it comes to creative people, ideas are coming and it feels like the music is writing itself, kind of thing. And I think one of the things that often gets lost in the flow story is how much preparation that takes. Yeah. So you take, for instance, jazz musicians who we see when they're on stage improvising in real time, creating a composition through dialogue right in front of an audience. It's a pretty amazing thing. But that takes a lot of practice going on behind the scenes, working out all the nuances of the language that is going to be spoken between those players when they're on the stage. And it's only that kind of preparation that enables the flow to take place.
Yeah, excellent.
I've always had the idea that during childhood, a lot of creativity comes out of children being bored, and then they turn to an alternative. And I was wondering if you thought that was true, and then as a corollary, it seems children have less time to be bored. And what we used to do is inventive play. We had nothing to do, and your mother said, go out and play in the yard. They're now sitting and using someone else's imagination on a screen. I've heard people say that that's even better. I'm not saying it's not. I was wondering how you gentlemen felt about that.
I think here's what I think. There's a lot of retrospective romanticization about our own childhoods where we think we did a lot of great stuff, but in fact, we wasted a ton of time being bored. And so the answer to this is not known, but I think it's a possibility that being able to access so much stuff and in 20 minutes I can watch some YouTube video about galaxies and then I can play a video game where I'm inside an atom and I'm doing things and then I can look up Wikipedia. That might be a lot better. Not being bored, but being able to process all that stuff and getting the world into my head that, we'll see over the next generation what happens. But my suspicion is that this is really very useful for making a smarter generation than we were.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an honor to be with all of you. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And we'll be available to answer.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.